I have been his lover for more than 6 years. I am the mother of his son, the only one who deserves to be his wife. Her heart had become an empty place inside of her, a gnawing black cavity that left her with nothing but despair and shattered dreams. Would it never end? After the elder Ika's daughter had been murdered, Kailia had hoped that Leto might turn to her at long last. But he still harbored dreams of a marital alliance that would strengthen the political, military, and economic power of House Atreides. Far below, the black cliffs were wet from mist hurled high by the breakers. Seabirds soared, sweeping insects from the air and plunging in pursuit of fish just beneath the waves. Green discolorations of algae and seaweed clung to notches in the rock. The broken reefs at the shore made the waters foam like a boiling cauldron. "My life is cursed," Kailia thought. "Everything that is mine has been stolen from me." She turned as matronly Kiara entered her private apartments without knocking. Kailia heard the rattle of cups and containers on an ornate tray, smelled the spice-laced coffee the old woman had brewed for her. The lady-in-waiting still moved with a muscular speed and agility that belied her withered appearance. Kiara set the tray down, trying to muffle the clatter, then picked up the fluted coffee pot and poured a rich brown stream into two cups. She added sugar to her own, cream to Kailia's. Her heart still heavy, the Ixian princess took the proffered cup from the woman and drew a delicate sip, trying not to show too much enjoyment. Kiara drank deeply and sat down in one of the chairs, as if she were the equal of the Duke's first concubine. Kailia's nostrils flared. "You take too many liberties, Kiara." The lady-in-waiting looked across the edge of her cup at the young woman, who should have been a prime marriage prospect to any great house. "Do you prefer a companion, Lady Kailia, or a mechanical servant? I have always been your friend and confidant. Perhaps you miss the self-motivated mechs you once had at your disposal on Ix." "Don't presume to tell me my wishes," Kailia said in a bleak voice. "I am grieving for a great man who has died by imperial treachery." Kiara's eyes glittered as she pounced. "Yes, and your mother was slain by them as well. You can't count on your brother to do anything but talk. He'll never get back your birthright." "You, Kailia," the matronly woman pointed a big-knuckled finger, "you are what remains of House Vernius, the heart and soul of your great family." "Don't you think I know that?" Kailia turned around again to look out the castle window. She could not face the old woman, could not face anyone or anything, not even her own fears. "If Leto marries that Archduke's daughter..." Angrily she shook her head. It would be worse than having that whore Jessica in the castle. The Caladan Sea stretched beyond the horizon, and the skies were veiled with clouds that pretended only winter gloom. She thought of her precarious position with Leto. He had taken her under his wing when she was just a girl, protected her after her world was destroyed. But those times were gone. Somehow the affection, even love, that had blossomed between them had withered and died. "Naturally, you fear that the Duke will accept the proposal and wed Ilesa Ikaz," Kiara added in a sweet voice, compassionate as a long, thin knife. She knew exactly how to prod the sorest spot. Although preoccupied with Jessica, Leto still came to Kailia's bed, though infrequently, as if out of obligation. And she submitted to him, as if it were her own duty as well. His Atreides' honor would never allow him to cast her out entirely, no matter how his feelings had changed. Instead, Leto chose a more subtle punishment by keeping her close to him, yet preventing her from achieving the glory that should have been hers. Oh, how she wished for sojourns on Kytane. Kylea longed to wear fine gowns, intricate and precious jewelry. She wanted to be attended by dozens of maidservants, not just one companion who concealed a sharp tongue with a honeyed voice. Glancing over at Kiara, her attention was caught by the blurred reflection of the old woman's features, the carefully coiffed hair that enhanced her noble appearance. Kylea's gleaming wall of blue obsidian, purchased by Leto at grand expense from Hagal stone merchants, had been a wonderful addition to Castle Caladan. Leto called it her contemplation surface, where Kylea could see dim shadows of the world around her and think about their implications. Blue obsidian was so rare that few houses in the Landsraad displayed even a single ornament, and Leto had procured this entire reflecting wall for her, as well as the stones in the banquet hall. But Kylea frowned. Kiara said that Leto had merely intended to buy her complacency, to make her accept her situation and silence her complaints. And now Gurney Halleck had told them that the rare substance actually came from Gedi Prime. Ah, the irony. She knew how the news must sting Leto's unfaithful heart. Kiara watched her lady's expression, knew the often-voiced thoughts that must be passing through her mind. And the old woman saw the wedge she needed. Before Leto can marry this daughter of Archduke Ekaz, you must consider your own dynastic matters, my lady. She stood beside the blue obsidian wall, and her reflection was distorted, a twisted figure who seemed trapped within the blurred glow of volcanic glass. Forget about your father and your brother, and even yourself. You have a son by Duke Leto Atreides. Your brother and Tessia have no children. So Victor is the true heir of House Vernius, and potentially of House Atreides as well. If anything were to happen to the Duke before he could take a wife and produce another son, Victor would become House Atreides. And since the boy is only 6, you would be regent for many years, my lady. It makes perfect sense. What do you mean if anything were to happen to Leto? Her heart clenched. She knew exactly what the old woman was suggesting. Coyly, Kiara finished her coffee, pouring herself a second cup without asking permission. Duke Paulus was slain in a bullfighting accident. You were there yourself, were you not? Kylea recalled the frightful image of the old Duke fighting a Seleucid bull in the Plaza de Toros. The tragic event had thrust Leto into the ducal seat years before his time. She had been a teenager then. Was Kiara hinting that it had not been an accident? Kylea had heard rumors, quickly hushed, but she'd considered it no more than jealous talk. The old woman withdrew, skirting the issue. It is not an idea to be considered seriously, I know, my dear. I raise it simply for the sake of argument. Kylea, though, could not get the insidious thoughts out of her head. She could imagine no other way for a child of her bloodline to lead a great house of the Landsraad. Otherwise, House Vernius would become extinct. She squeezed her eyes shut. If Leto does agree to marry Ilesa Ekaz after all, you will have nothing. Kiara picked up the tray and made as if to leave. She had planted her seeds and done her work. Your Duke already spends most of his time with that Bene Gesserit whore. Clearly you mean nothing to him. I doubt he remembers any promises he made to you in moments of passion. Blinking in surprise at the old woman, Kylea wondered how Kiara could possibly know what bedroom secrets Leto had whispered in her ear. But the thought of Duke Atreides caressing young, bronze-haired Jessica, with her generous mouth and smooth oval face, turned her annoyance with Kiara's impertinence into hatred toward Leto himself. You must ask yourself a difficult question, my lady. Where does your loyalty truly lie? With Duke Leto, or with your family? Since he has not seen fit to give you his name, you will always remain Avernius. The old woman removed the tray, leaving Kylea with her own lukewarm cup of coffee. Kiara departed without saying farewell, without asking if her lady needed anything else. Kylea remained in her chamber, looking over trinkets and baubles that reminded her of the terrible losses she had sustained. Her noble house and the finery of the Grand Palais. Her chances to join the imperial court. With a pang in her heart, she saw one of the sketches she had drawn of her hearty father, bringing to mind Dominic's laughter. How the big, bald man had trained her in business matters. Then, with an equal sense of loss, she thought of her son Victor, and all the things he would never have. For Kylea, the hardest part was coming to the horrible decision. Once she had made up her mind, though, the rest was just details. The individual is the key, the final effective unit of all biological process. Partit Kynes. For years, Leet Kynes had yearned for beautiful, dark-haired Ferula with all his heart. But when he finally faced the prospect of marrying her, he felt only emptiness and a sense of obligation. To be entirely proper, he waited 3 months after Warwick's death, though both he and Ferula knew their betrothal was a foregone conclusion. He had made a death vow to his friend. According to Freeman custom, men took the wives and children of those they vanquished in knife fights or single-handed combat. Ferula, however, was not a ganima, a spoil of war. Leet had spoken with Naib Hainar, professing his love and dedication, citing the solemn promises he'd made to Warwick that he would care for his wife as the most precious of women, and accept responsibility for her young son as his own. Old Hainar had regarded him with his one-eyed gaze. The Naib knew what had transpired, knew the sacrifice Warwick had made during the Coriolis storm. As far as the elders of Redwall Siege were concerned, Warwick had perished out in the desert. The visions he claimed to have received from God were obviously false, for he had failed in the testing. Thus, Hainar gave his permission, and Leet Kynes prepared to marry the Naib's daughter. Sitting in his room behind the tapestry hangings of dyed spice fiber, Leet pondered his impending wedding. Freeman superstition did not allow him to see Ferula for 2 days before the formal ceremony. Both man and wife had to undergo Mendi purification rituals. The time was spent in beautification and in writing out statements of devotion, promises, and love poems that would later be shared with each other. Now, though, Leet wallowed in shameful thoughts, wondering if he had somehow caused this tragedy to happen. Was it the fervent desire he'd voiced upon seeing the white Bian? There, he and Warwick had both wished to marry the young woman. Leet had tried to accept his defeat graciously at the Cave of Birds, suppressing the selfish voice in the back of his mind that had never allowed him to forget how much he still wanted her. Did my secret wishes cause this tragedy to happen? Now Ferula would be his wife, but it was a union born of sadness. Ah, forgive me, Warwick, my friend. He continued to sit in silence, waiting for time to tick away, until the hour was at hand and the siege ceremony would begin. He wasn't looking forward to it, not under these circumstances. With a rustle of heavy cloth, the door hanging parted and Leet's mother entered. Freeth smiled at him with sympathy and understanding. She carried a stoppered flask that had been ornately embroidered, stitched together out of skins, and then sealed with spice resin to keep it waterproof. She held the flask as if it were a precious treasure, a gift of immeasurable price. "I've brought you something, dearest, in preparation for your wedding." Leet emerged from his troubled thoughts. "I've never seen that before." "It is said that when a woman feels a special destiny for her child, when she senses great things will come from him, she instructs the midwives to distill and retain the amniotic fluid from the birth. A mother may give this to her son on his wedding day." She extended the flask. "Keep it well, Leet. This is the last commingling of your essence and mine, from the time we shared one body. Now you will commingle your life with another. Two hearts, when joined, may yield the strength of more than two." Trembling with emotion, he accepted the soft flask. "It is the greatest gift I could give to you," Freeth said, "on this important but difficult day." Looking up at her, Leet met her dark eyes with an intent gaze. The emotions she perceived in his face were enough to startle her. "No, Mother. You gave me life, and that is a far greater blessing." When the betrothed couple stood before the members of the Siege, Leet's mother and the younger women waited in designated spaces, while the elders stepped forward to speak for the young man. The boy, Leet Chi, son of Warwick, waited silently beside his mother. Pardit Kynes, taking a break from his terraforming work, grinned as never before. It surprised him how proud he felt to see his son getting married. Kynes remembered his own wedding out on the dunes at night. It had been so long ago, shortly after his arrival on Arrakis, and he had spent much of the time in distraction. Unbetrothed Freeman girls had danced like dervishes on the sand, chanting. The Sayyidina had pronounced the words of the ceremony. His own marriage to Freeth had turned out well enough. He had a fine son, whom he had groomed to take over his work one day. Kynes smiled at Leet, whose name came from, he suddenly remembered, the assassin Ulit, whom Hynar and the elders had sent to kill him, back when the Freeman had considered him an outsider, a stranger with frightful dreams and ways. But that assassin had seen the grandeur of the planetologist's vision, and had fallen on his own Chrisknife. The Freeman saw omens in everything, and ever since, Pardit Kynes had been provided with the resources of 10 million Freemen at his beck and call. Dune's reshaping, the plantings and the reclamation of the desert, had proceeded at a remarkable pace. As the couple stood in front of the assemblage, with Leet gazing upon his bride longingly, Pardit felt disturbed at the fixity of his son's attention, the opening of the young man's already wounded heart. He loved his son in a different way, as an extension of himself. Pardit Kynes wanted Leet to assume the mantle of planetologist when it was time to pass it on. Unlike his father, Leet seemed too vulnerable to emotions. Pardit loved his wife well enough, as she performed her traditional role as a Freeman companion, but his work was more important than the marital relationship. He had been captivated by dreams and ideas. He felt the passion for restoring this planet to a lush Eden. But he had never been engulfed by a single person. Naib Hynar performed the ceremony himself, since the old Sayyidina had been unable to travel across the sands. As Kynes listened to the young couple speaking their vows to each other, he felt a strange pall settle over this wedding, a heavy worry about his son's mindset. "Leet, satisfy me as to thine eyes, and I will satisfy thee as to thy heart," Ferula's answer. "Satisfy me as to thy feet, and I will satisfy thee as to thy hands. Satisfy me as to thy sleeping, and I will satisfy thee as to thy waking. And she completed the spoken prayer. Satisfy me as to thy desire, and I will satisfy thee as to thy need. With two sinewy hands, Hainar grasped the palms of the bride and groom, holding them together and raising them up so the entire Sich could see. You are now united in the water. A subdued cheer rose, which grew in intensity until it became heartfelt, happy, and welcoming. Both Leet and Ferula looked relieved. Later, after the celebration, Pardit came to see his son alone in a passageway. Awkwardly, he clasped Leet's shoulders in the semblance of a hug. I'm so happy for you, my son. He struggled for the proper words. You must be filled with joy. You have wanted that girl for a long time, haven't you? He grinned, but Leet's eyes flashed with anger, as if the elder kinds had just struck him an unfair blow. Why do you torment me, father? Haven't you done enough already? Baffled, Pardit stepped back and released his son's shoulders. What do you mean? I'm congratulating you on your wedding. Is she not the woman you've always wanted to be with? I thought, not like this. How can I be happy with this shadow hanging over us? Perhaps it will go away in a few years, but for now I feel too much pain. Leet, my son? Pardit's expression must have told Leet all he needed to know. You don't understand a thing, do you, father? The great Amakines! He laughed bitterly. With your plantings, and your dunes, and your weather stations, and your climate maps. You are so blind, I pity you. The planetologist's mind reeled as he tried to place the angry words into some grid of meaning, like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Warwick? Your friend? Then he stopped. He died accidentally, didn't he, in the storm? Father, you missed it all. Leet hung his head. I am proud of your dreams for Dune. But you see our entire world as an experiment, just a test bed where you play with theories, where you collect data. Don't you see? These aren't experiments. These aren't test subjects. These are people. These are the freemen. They have taken you in, given you a life, given you a son. I am freemen. Well, so am I. Pardit's tone was indignant. In a husky tone so low that no one else could hear, Leet said, You're just using them. Pardit, startled, didn't respond. Leet's voice rose in pitch and volume. He knew the freeman would hear portions of this argument and would be disturbed at the friction between their prophet and his heir. You've spoken to me all my life, father. When I recall our conversations, though, I only remember you reciting reports from botanical stations and discussing new phases of adapted plant life. Have you ever said a thing about my mother? Have you ever talked to me as a father rather than as a colleague? Leet pounded his own chest. I do feel your dream. I do see the wonders you've brought in hidden corners of the desert. I do understand the potential that lies beneath the sands of Dune. But even when you do accomplish everything you wish, will you bother to notice? Try to put a human face on your plans and see who will reap the benefits of your efforts. Look at the face of a child. Look into the eyes of an old woman. Live your life, father. Helpless, Pardit sagged onto a bench against a curved rock wall. I've meant well, he said, his voice thick in his throat. His eyes brimmed with tears of shame and confusion as he looked at his son. You are truly my successor. At times I've wondered if you would ever learn enough about planetology. but now I see I was wrong. You understand more things than I can ever know." Leet sank onto the bench beside his father. Hesitantly, the planetologist reached over and placed a hand on his son's shoulder, more meaningfully this time. In turn, Leet reached up to touch the hand, and looked with Freeman amazement at the tears pouring down his father's cheeks. "You are truly my successor as Imperial Planetologist," Pardet said. "You understand my dream. But without you it will be even greater, because you have a heart as well as a vision." Good leadership is largely invisible. When everything runs smoothly, no one notices a duke's work. That is why he must give the people something to cheer, something to talk about, something to remember. Duke Paulus Atreides. Kylea saw her chance during an interminable family dinner in the grand banquet hall of Castle Caladan. Looking happy, black-haired Leto sat in the ducal chair at the head of the long table, while household servants delivered tureens of a spicy fish stew commonly enjoyed by the lower classes of fishermen and villagers. Leto ate with gusto, savoring the crude dish. Perhaps it reminded him of his childhood running loose on the docks, jumping aboard fishing boats, and avoiding his studies on the leadership of a great house. As far as Kylea was concerned, old Duke Paulus had allowed his only heir to spend too much time with commoners and their petty concerns, and not enough time learning political nuances. It was clear to her that Duke Leto had never understood how to run his household and deal with the disparate forces of the Guild, Chome, the Emperor, and the Landsraad. Beside his father, Victor sat on a thickly cushioned chair, raised so that he could eat at the same level. The dark-haired boy slurped his soup, imitating his father, while Leto did his best to outdo the 6-year-old in making noise. With her elegant background, it especially displeased Kylea how her son tried to copy his father's rough edges. Some day, when the boy became the true Atreides heir and Kylea was regent, she would train him properly, so that he might appreciate the obligations of his birthright. Victor would have the best of both House Atreides and House Vernius. Around the table, the others tore hunks from loaves of bread and drank bitter Caladan ale, though Kylea knew there were plenty of fine wines in the cellar. Laughter and casual conversation drifted, but she didn't participate and instead picked at her food. Several seats away, Gurney Halleck had brought his new balisette to the table and would entertain them during dessert. Because this man had been close to the father neither Kylea nor her brother had known, she felt pleased to have him there, despite the fact that Gurney had not been overly friendly toward her. Sitting across from her, Romber seemed perfectly content with his concubine Tessia, and with trying to best Leto in the quantity of fish stew he could consume. In his own chair, Thufir Hawat sat deep in concentration, studying the people around the table, neglecting his meal. The Mentat's gaze slid from face to face, and Kylea tried to avoid eye contact. Halfway down the table sat Jessica, as if to demonstrate that they were equals in the ducal household. The nerve of that woman. Kylea wanted to strangle her. The attractive Bene Gesserit ate with measured movements, so assured in her position that she exhibited no self-consciousness. She saw Jessica pause and study Leto's face, as if able to read every nuance of expression as easily as words imprinted on a shigawire spool. This evening Leto had called them all to eat together, though Kylea could think of no special occasion, anniversary, or holiday he meant to celebrate. She suspected the Duke had thought up some wild and inadvisable scheme, one he'd insist upon completing no matter what advice she or anyone else gave him. Glow globes hovered above the table like decorations, surrounding the articulated arms of the poison snooper that drifted high above their food, like a hovering insect. The snooper was a necessary device, given the twisted politics of Lansrod feuds. Leto finished his large bowl of stew and dabbed his mouth with an embroidered linen napkin. He leaned back in the hand-carved ducal chair with a contented sigh. Victor did the same on the high cushions of his own seat. He had finished barely a third of the stew in his small bowl. Having already decided what song to play after dinner, Gurney Halleck looked over at his 9-string balisette leaning against the wall. Kylea watched Leto's gray eyes, how his gaze drifted from one end of the banquet hall to the other, from the portrait of Paulus Atreides to the mounted bull's head, its rack of horns still stained with blood. She didn't know what the Duke was thinking, but as she looked across the table, the witchling Jessica met her gaze with green eyes, as if she understood what Leto was about to do. Kylea turned away, frowning. When Leto stood up, Kylea drew a deep sigh. He was about to engage in one of his interminable ducal speeches, trying to inspire them about all the good things in their lives. But if life was so good, why had both of her parents been murdered? Why did she and her brother, the heirs of a great house, remain in exile, rather than enjoying what should have been theirs? Two servants hurried forward to remove the soup dishes and leftover bread, but Leto waved them away so that he might speak uninterrupted. Next week is the 20th anniversary of the bullfight in which my father was killed. He looked up at the matador portrait. Consequently, I've been thinking of the grand entertainments Duke Paulus performed for his subjects. They loved my father for that, and I think it's about time I created a worthy spectacle, as would be expected from a Duke of Caladan. Instantly, Hawat raised his guard. What is it you intend, my Duke? Nothing so dangerous as a bullfight, Thufir. Leto grinned down at Victor, then over at Romber. But I want to do something the people will talk about for a long time to come. I'm leaving soon for the Lansrad Council on Kaitain to begin a new diplomatic mission in the Mauritani-Ikazi conflict, especially now that we might be forming a much stronger alliance with Ikaz. He paused for a moment, appearing embarrassed. As a grand send-off, I'm going to take our largest sky clipper on a magnificent procession across the lowlands. My people can look up and see the banners and the colorful airship, and wish their duke well in his mission. We'll pass above the fishing flotillas and then inland over the Pundi rice farms. Victor clapped his hands while Gurney nodded in approval. Oh, it will be a marvelous sight! Leaning his elbows on the table, Romber rested his square chin in his hands. Leto, isn't Duncan Idaho returning soon from Ginaz? Will you be away when he arrives, or can we combine his homecoming with the same celebration? Pondering this, Leto shook his head. I haven't heard anything in some time. We don't expect him for a couple of months yet. Gurney thumped a hand on the table. Gods below! If he's coming to us as a swordmaster of Ginaz after 8 long years of training, the man deserves a reception of his own, don't you think? Leto laughed. Indeed, Gurney. Plenty of time for that when I return. With you, Thufir, and Duncan bearing swords for me, I need never fear a scratch from an enemy.
There are other ways an enemy can strike, my lord, Jessica said with a low warning in her voice. Kylea stiffened, but Leto didn't notice. Instead, he looked at the witch.
I'm fully aware of that. Already, wheels were turning in Kylea's mind. At the conclusion of the meal, she excused herself and went to tell Kiara what Leto planned to do. That night, Leto slept on a cot in a hangar of the Kala Municipal Spaceport, while his household staff went about making preparations for the gala event, delivering announcements and gathering supplies.
Within a few days, the sail-enhanced Sky Clipper would begin its grand and colorful procession. Left alone in her chambers, Kailia summoned Swain Guar and seduced him, as she had done many times in the past. She made love to the guard captain with a feral passion that surprised and exhausted him. He looked so much like Leto, but was such a different man. Afterward, when he had fallen asleep beside her, she stole a tiny code-locked key from a concealed pocket in his thick leather belt, which was curled on the floor. Only rarely used, it would be some time before Guar noticed the missing key. The following morning, she pressed the small object into Kiara's leathery palm and squeezed the old woman's fingers over it. "This will give you access to the Atreides armory. Move with care." Kiara's raven-like eyes sparkled, and quickly she tucked the key into secret folds of her layered garments. "I will handle the rest, my lady." War, as the foremost ecological disaster of any age, merely reflects the larger state of human affairs in which the total organism called humanity finds its existence. Parted Kinds, Reflections on the Disaster at Seleucia Secundus. On the administration island of Ginaz, the five greatest living swordmasters met and judged their remaining students in the oral examination phase of their curriculum, grilling them on history, philosophy, military tactics, haiku, music, and more, all according to the exacting requirements and traditions of the school. But this was a somber, tragic occasion. The entire school archipelago remained in an uproar, outraged and grieving for the six slain students. Flaunting their barbarity, the Grummans had dumped four of the bodies in the surf near the main training center, where they had washed up on shore. The other two, Duncan Idaho and He Eresser, remained missing, likely lost at sea. On the top floor of the central tower, the swordmasters sat along the straight side of a semicircular table, their ceremonial swords extended point outward on the surface in front of them, like the rays of a sun. Each student who stood in front of the table would see the threatening points while he answered rigorous questions. They had all passed. Now Karsty Topper and the school administration would arrange travel for the successful students to return to their respective homes, where they would apply what they had learned. Some had already gone to the nearby spaceport. And the swordmasters were left with the consequences. Fat Rivi Denari sat in the center, drawing out the sword of Duke Paulus Atreides and a jeweled Mauritani heirloom knife, found among the possessions of Idaho and Resser. Beside him, Mord Kerr hung his gray-maned head. "We have had much experience sending back the keepsakes of fallen students, but never like this." Sinewy Master Jamo Reed, though hardened from overseeing his prison island for many years, could not stop weeping. He shook his head. "If Ginaz students die, it should be during difficult training, not because they are murdered." Ginaz had lodged formal protests, issuing culturally tailored insults and censures, none of which meant anything to Viscount Hundro Mauritani. He had never made satisfactory amends for his brutal attacks on Ekaz. The Landsrat and the Emperor were now holding hearings on the best means of response, with the leaders of many great houses traveling to Kaitane in order to speak with the council. But they had never managed more than censures, fines, and slaps on the hand, even for a mad dog like the Viscount. The Grummans believed they could get away with anything. "I feel violated," Jay Wu said, his dreadlocks hanging in disarray. "No one has ever dared to do this sort of thing to a swordmaster." Foppish Whitmore Blood sat up straighter and fiddled with the ruffles on his shirt, the heavy cuffs at his wrists. "I propose that we rename six of our islands after the murdered students. History will remember the dastardly crime, and we will honor the six." "Honor?" Rividenari slapped his fat palm on the tabletop, making the sword blades jangle. How can you use such a word in this context? I spent 3 hours last night by Jule Naret's burial vault, praying and asking what he would do in such a situation. And did he answer you? Scowling, Jae-woo stood up and went to look out the window, at the flat spaceport and the foamy reefs. Even in his own lifetime, Jule Naret never taught anybody. He drowned in a tidal wave, and his disciples tried to emulate him. If Naret never helped his closest followers, he certainly won't help us. Blood sniffed, looking offended. The great man taught by example. A perfectly valid technique for those capable of learning. And he had honor. Just like the ancient samurai, Denari said. After tens of thousands of years, we have grown less civilized. We have forgotten. Frowning in contemplation, Mord Kerr looked over at the obese swordmaster. You are forgetting history, Denari. The samurai may have had honor. But once the British arrived in Japan with guns, the samurai vanished. Within a generation. Jamo Reed looked up, his lean face devastated beneath a snowy white cap of frizzy hair. Please, we must not fight among ourselves, or else the Grummans will have beaten us. Jae-woo snorted. They've already... A commotion at the doorway interrupted him. He turned from the window as the other four swordmasters rose to their feet in shock. Dirty and disheveled, Duncan Idaho and He'e Resser pushed past the objections of three uniformed school employees, knocking the men aside in the corridor. The two young men strode into the room, battered and limping, but with a fire in their eyes. Are we too late? Resser asked with a forced grin. Jamo Reed ran around the table to embrace Duncan, then Resser. My boys, you are alive! Even Jae-woo had a relieved and astonished smile on his iguana-like face. A swordmaster has no need to state the obvious, he said. But Jamo Reed didn't care. Duncan's gaze lit on the old Duke's sword lying on the semicircular table. He took a step forward and looked down at the blood oozing from a gash on his left shin, soaking through the leg of his ill-fitting pants. Resser and I haven't actually been studying for the past several days, but we have been putting your training into practice. Resser swayed a little, having trouble staying on his feet, but Duncan supported him. After gulping cups of water that Mord Kerr gave them, they explained how they had jumped overboard in the rough seas, swimming and helping each other to distance themselves from the large dark boat. Straining their abilities to the limit, clinging to every scrap of knowledge they had learned during 8 years of rigorous swordmaster training, they had remained afloat for hours. They did their best to navigate by the stars, until finally the tides and currents carried them to one of the numerous islands, luckily a civilized one. From there they had secured minimal first aid and dry clothes, as well as immediate transportation. Though his good humor had been damaged by the ordeal, Resser still managed to raise his chin. We would like to formally request a delay in our final examination, sirs. Delay? Jamo Reed said with tears in his eyes again. I suggest a dispensation. Surely these two have proven themselves to our satisfaction.